Thank you, Michael, and thanks to everyone for coming again. I echo all of those sentiments. Nice to see so many familiar faces and a few new ones as well. And don't worry, there's no initiation ceremony or anything like that, no form of hazing. Before we talk about the upcoming play, which I'm very excited to hear about and also to see, I want to acknowledge that we're on the traditional territories and we all gather on the traditional territories of the Lekwungen-speaking people, and we're grateful to call this place home. Our first guest, as you heard, and we're grateful to have her with us as well as the guest afterwards, because this is such a busy week. You can imagine, you know, you imagine hosting a dinner party or putting on anything involving other people, and if you're anything like me, you're scrambling the last few hours or few days. So imagine putting on a play and a premiere. It's a busy weekend for our first two guests, and we're grateful to have them taking some time with us. And if they have to run out, you know it's for a good reason after the fact. Tara Bagan is a proud Tlacahbamuch and Irish-Canadian half-breed. She has written 28 plays and has served as artistic director of Native Earth Performing Arts in Toronto. She's been playwright in residence at the National Arts Centre in Ottawa and Cahoots Theatre in Toronto. Together with Andy Morrow, she co-founded and co-runs Article 11, which is dedicated to the creation of live performance works with an inclusive model inspired by traditional Indigenous ways of living. Article 11 has toured to Ottawa, Toronto, Kamloops, Winnipeg, Saskatoon, Edinburgh, New Zealand, and Australia. And it's a great pleasure to have Tara Bagan, Bagan with us. Please welcome Tara Bagan to Before Play. Good morning.
Glorious. Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's shining right on you. That's perfect. Can you tell us, before we talk about the play, about a bit about your own experience in the theater world? How did you get your start? How did you get into the theater world?
In second grade, I had a wonderful teacher who decided we were all going to do a play. And we were doing both Sleeping Beauty and Snow White. And I was really hoping to get Snow White. But I got the witch in Sleeping Beauty, which of course is way more interesting. I got to turn into a dragon and like slay the boy that I loved. His name was Hans. And I was hooked. I was quite tiny as a child, so I felt like I was overlooked and not heard often. But on stage, it was like I had a voice and I had feedback afterwards, and it was like, oh, it felt like I existed. I had a voice. So that was the hook, and I just foolishly never look back.
Back in grade two. And when did you make a decision? Was it a conscious decision to pursue the theater professionally at some point?
Yes. I mean, that was the direction from the age of seven. And then I trained at Red Deer College right out of high school and did 2 years of theater performance there. And was told by a prof, and I think this happens often to theater professionals, you're told maybe you should do something else. And I think that's what they do to try to weed out the easily, you know, shakeable. So I was like, oh, right, I'm taking 1 year away from theater. And I lasted maybe 3 weeks and then was auditioning already. So, yeah, it's a compulsion.
It's a compulsion.
Yeah.
So what can you tell us about the Ministry of Grace? What was the inspiration behind the play, first of all?
The inspiration is my own late grandmother, Mary August, Mary Collins, who in 1950, she was quite a young woman at that time, and her children were 5 and 6. And she managed to keep my mom, who's the elder, she managed to keep them both at home until the other one, the boy, was of school age, because she was hoping they'd be in the same class at least, that residential school in Kamloops. So they were both taken off in the back of a cattle truck in 1950. And my grandmother couldn't bear being at home without them. So she responded to this call for laborers in California and worked on a cotton plantation and briefly, and was thereafter recruited by a traveling evangelical minister to read the Bible on stage as a tamed heathen act. So, and that was short-lived because her my great-great aunt Marie wrote her a letter because she had this horrible dream of her niece being kind of like consumed by these white clouds, which we assume was maybe the cotton plantation. We don't know. But the letter was quite firmly stated, and my grandmother traveled back home shortly thereafter. And those are the facts that we know. She was very, very reticent to speak of it throughout her life. So she passed when I was 5, so I actually got permission from her sisters, my now late great auntie Hazel and great auntie Diana, who gave me permission to fictionalize, fill in all of the empty, untold story. They thought it was a hoot that I would want to do so I did it.
And just to be clear, only to be clear, it is a fictionalized treatment of that true starting place. If
that's
I can put
right.
it that
yeah,
way.
Yeah, there are some touchstones that we deal with in the telling of the Ministry of Grace. But yes, it's very much inspired by my granny.
Can you tell us a bit about that process, about going from that idea, that deep part of your and fundamental important part of your family history towards the play that is about to be staged?
Sure. I believe that when the story is one that the time is right for it to be told, and if I am the right person to be telling it, and I'm healthy and open enough to receive it, I believe that much of it arrives to me, like it's gifted. It's not just me. It's of course all the ancestors that have been and will be, and I get to type it out, and then, I mean, it's a trick because of course it's all everything that your writing is infused with who you are as a person. And so in some ways, every character has traits that you have, so it's always very revealing, necessarily. But you're also very aware that you're reflecting, that you're, because the work is public, you're in many ways an ambassador, not only to your community, but to your family and to my mom, who's my dearest, dearest friend. So there's a sense of responsibility, and I feel very accountable to those people I feel responsible for and to. And I'm fortunate enough that I'm really very well held by them. So it's something that I can forge ahead with to a certain point, and then you need everybody else. You need brilliant actors and designers and to get it on its feet, and then the real art of unpacking the initial impulses happens.
Was it natural then that you would end up directing it, not just writing it and creating it in that sense?
Sometimes I'm certain that I'm not the right director for something that I've written. I can't even really articulate why I felt that I was the right director for this, except that it felt quite complete, more complete than some plays, that just the world of it, the feel of it, and partially my teenage obsession with John Steinbeck, which is also very much so the kind of world that this one sits in. So it's, yeah, it was kind of activating a way of storytelling that I've always loved, so it felt right.
When you're both the writer and the director, do you find yourself tinkering as you go along? Or okay, so the writer yes. didn't just immediately disappear, and now you're as the director stuck with
no.
the writer's script.
In fact, I have a cut to give today.
Ah.
Yeah. Right. And you know, ego of course can get in the way. There's this scene that's like, oh, and the actors do it so beautifully, and they have so much fun with it, and it's a real moment of like an unleashing kind of moment. And I know it has to go. And you know, we're so fortunate here at the Belfry that the artistic leadership is strong, but also very generous. Michael Shimada and Taiwo. I've had beautiful input that just to help strengthen an arc of one character that will strengthen everybody else's around it. So that wonderful thing when you cut something and then that thing falls away and then everything is better because of it. It's super fun.
Given the sensitive nature of so much of this story, I mean, I can't, if you don't mind me saying, just as a parent, I cannot imagine someone taking my children away from me. What would you do? What kind of conversations have you had with everybody involved, especially the cast, about this?
Yeah, it's interesting because many of my plays, all of the characters are Indigenous. In this work, we've got two and two. So, and actually the design team is similarly an assorted bunch. Every Indigenous person on the project has a direct relationship to residential school or to day schools in some cases. So those things can well up. They can become so very present in the room that they just need to be given their time. And once again, because the Belfry is a beautiful place to be, we're able to do what we need to do, which is we do a lot. We smudge with sage when we want to. We take the moment. We just acknowledge it and allow it to be there, and maybe take a break earlier, take an additional break, or and then on the other side of it, we also have very very funny people in the project. So when it needs to happen, Sheldon's up and singing or dancing or making us all laugh, or So it's been a good caretaking experience, so that we can keep moving forward through those difficult points, and also allow them to be there.
I want to ask you about another venture of yours that I mentioned in the introduction. You're co-founder and co-director with Andy Morrow of Article 11, Indigenous Activist Artist Creation and Production Company. Now, people familiar with the news might recognize Article 11 that comes from UNDRIP, the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. How did that inspire the creation of your theater company and its mandate?
We had been talking for some time about establishing our own company and hadn't really decided on a name. And for whatever reason, we found ourselves working our way through UNDRIPS because we felt we should be familiar with it. And Article 11 very particularly speaks to the right to create any and all of our art and cultural practices in the contemporary world in exactly the way that we see fit. So it's funny how these basic rights have to be declared, but of course they do. And we, Andy and I, often found ourselves confronting organizations within the industry that where we really feel like those rights are not respected, and where in fact for an Indigenous artist to make their way through as a professional, there are more roadblocks in place. So we really prefer as our own twosome company to work outside of those ways. So we don't like to work with any of the they don't call themselves a union, but the stage unions or within the Canadian Theatre Agreement, all of those things which have their place and purpose. We work with our own values, and we come together with the company and establish what we're going to do, that everything is flexible, that we will always shape the work around what it wants to be rather than adhering to particular rules. And we also pay way above scale, which is a great thing to do, because it's our firm belief that when you have an Indigenous artist on a team, not only is that person fluent in hegemonic society, but they're bringing to you their own ancestral wisdom. So that's that. You can't even put a number on that. So in order that our colleagues can not have to be torn between choosing between theater or an indie film or something, we try to at least pay as much as an indie film would do. So which is unusual for theater. Most theaters go bare minimum. That's not the case at the Belfry, but most theaters go bare minimum. It's kind of a culture of poverty in a way, and we want to break out of that.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned you're here at the Belfry. You mentioned Michael and the artistic team. I wonder, the Belfry has made a commitment to try to tell Indigenous stories and with Indigenous storytellers. What's your general sense of that? Is that a growing movement across the country, or is it too few and far between still? What do you think?
It was popular during Canada 150. and now that funding is no longer available, it's much less much less so. So you kind of can sense the patterns. It's like, oh, a larger venue holding company will do their Indigenous show. Then you're like, oh, well, I won't even bother pitching to them for 3 or 4 years because they've checked that box, so that they're not going to be interested anymore. So which is largely why Article 11, we often get invited by our fauna in Aotearoa or out to Australia, the Gadigal country. It's interesting how much more regularly we get invited, and with the full amount of budget we require, not in Canada.
Hmm. Well, I wonder finally what you hope audiences take away from the Ministry of Grace. You're often, and we understand that you're off to make cuts to the script and do rehearsals and carry on. What do you hope audiences take away once it's all been staged?
I'm never sure about that until I get asked, but I'm... A part of what I love about the telling is that it is a period piece. And I know from working in historic sites in university that one of the greatest things about touring people through a historic site is that you have stories reciprocated. So it evokes something for people. It brings them back to a place or memories maybe that they hadn't gone to the top of the pile in a while. So I love that. I love that it helps people to relate to what it means to walk through the land that we all share now, but as Indigenous people, and how those circumstances, while very different, are always also parallel. So, you know, as much as I hate it when reviewers say, oh, it was such a human story, as if I'm not, you know, as if our actors aren't, in many ways, I know that I need to be grateful for that, because what it means is that in some way the telling has expanded empathy. So that's ultimately the goal.
Tara, thank you for joining us. Thanks for taking the time this morning.
Thank you. Thank you for coming.
Tara Bagan is the director and creator of the Ministry of Grace. Our next guest is PJ Prudet, who is a Toronto-based, Northern Saskatchewan-hailing, proud Métis actor, a writer of plays and creative fiction. As an artist, PJ is galvanized by the Indigenous perspective, experience, and stories of this land. She's creator in residence at Night Swimming Theatre and RBC resident creator at Canadian Stage. PJ has performed as a company actor at both the National Arts Centre English Theatre and the Shaw Festival, and has been fortunate enough as an artist to tour shows extensively across the country multiple times over. She is a former playwright in res for Native Earth Performing Arts and writer in the Natural Resources Creation Group at the Factory Theatre. PJ is a recent nominee for the inaugural Johanna Metcalf Performing Arts Award and a laureate of the Reveal Indigenous Art Award. Her play Réunir, inspired by the Métis resistance, was nominated for a SATA Award. Recently, she performed in the Ministry of Grace, as she's about to do, and the Unnatural and Accidental Women. And please welcome PJ to Before Play. I'm getting a bit ahead of myself with your bio.
Thank you so much.
Leaping forward a few months. Great to have you with us. Can you tell us a bit about how you got into theater as well, before we talk about Ministry of Grace?
Yeah, I grew up actually in Saskatchewan, and the town that I grew up in as a rather small child, we didn't have a lot of theater. It was really more of a sports town. But once in a while, we would do some sort of fun little show. And I think the first show that I was actually able to do, I wanted to be the singer. There was this beautiful role. I think it was like a Robin Hood rendition. And the lead, I forget her name, but she was like the singer of the land. And I really wanted that part, but my best friend got it, which, you know, I was really happy for her. I remember crying. This is my first moment of humility, going, I'm so happy for you right now. And then I got to play the court jester, so it actually was really fun for me because I got to be a trickster. So I remember doing cartwheels and holding up silly signs and making the audience laugh silently. But, physically. So.
And so you got a start at a fairly young age as well.
I suppose so. I think the first genre of storytelling that I was exposed to was actually film. My mom is an avid movie watcher, and so when she was a youth, her family didn't have a lot of money, but her father would always take them to see cinema in a neighboring town. And so, you know, they would spend whatever, 5 cents or whatever it was at that time, and go see a movie. And so she's always been someone very very much in love with storytelling. And so when I ended up living with her in a larger community, where I think the very first show that I got to do on a larger scale was West Side Story.
Oh, wow.
And so I was one of the chorus at 16, and that was very eye-opening, because it was people from all across the province that had been cast in the show, and it was a very community-oriented event. So we had people would come, these amazing artists would come in and create graffiti on this. It was the old powerhouse station out of town, and so it was a really amazing experience. So I kind of slowly.
Was that the spark for theater for you, do you think, or live performance, or?
Yeah, I guess I always. Like Tara, I think I always had just a wish to be heard, and so there's just a, you know, the way of experiencing being a storyteller, what that actually entails. You know, the very first moment that I think as a youth, I saw a movie that also set in this era, in the 1950s, was the first moment where I watched an actor, a young actor. Play this part of someone going through a major journey, and that was the moment, I think, when I realized that I really wanted to be a performer, be an actor.
And we got a sense from the introduction of your wide experience in Canadian theatre and beyond. And I wonder what you've observed in the last few years. The beginning of change in Canadian theatre, or maybe not. Theatre companies and individual artists conscious of the need to create and hold space for Indigenous work. Has much changed in your opinion, or no?
I guess for me, the largest drive as an artist and the greatest welcoming I've had has been within Indigenous communities, and so within Indigenous theater communities. And for whatever reason, that has always been the pull and the force with which I have been able to create from. And I guess Tara and I met almost 12 years ago, and in Toronto at Native Earth, we were working on a show called A Very Polite Genocide, and it was a very special piece. And I think just for me, the moments of being of recognizing how I was being upheld and supported by Indigenous artists was gobsmacking. I hadn't expected to find a sense of home with fellow artists, and so that was a very huge deal to be welcomed and then also seen. And so since then, I feel as though my career has always stuck to that path of speaking from or engaging from creatively from a place of indigeneity. I can't really speak to, I think in a sense, I don't really know, to be honest, how it is seen from other perspectives outside of being a part of these shows. I know that it is rare in some ways to it is rare and magnificent and to be experiencing a show like Ministry of Grace here at the Belfry. So I believe that there are people who want to know these stories and are coming from this place of bringing these shows and these artists in, like Michael and the Belfry. And definitely there are people who, within our own communities, that are upholding and wanting to express these forms of storytelling. And so I think there's becoming more and more of a community. The communities are expanding, and so there's so many more stories that are really being awakened and finding a place that we weren't always given before, and now we're just taking that space. So,
and you're telling a lot of new stories, or at least retelling stories, but also bringing some back. Margot Kane, an icon in Canadian theatre and a pioneer in Indigenous theatre, 17 years after she retired her one-person play, Moon Lodge. I understand you were the first actor to give the play a second life. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, that wasn't intimidating at all. I don't know. I'm not sure how many people may have seen Margot's show, Moon Lodge. Anyone in this audience? Out of curiosity. She toured that internationally, all across the continent. She's a real trailblazer, and I think she was telling this story long before. I think a lot of our stories were recognized and upheld, and so she really just laid ground for it. I was working at the National Arts Center as one of the ensemble for a season, and part of my contract for about 2 weeks after the other ensemble members had left, I was asked to stay and do a workshop production of Moon Lodge, which ended up being larger. It ended up being substantially more than a workshop it felt, because it also merged with the first time that the National Arts Center had brought in a sense of all the artists across the country to discuss the opening of the Indigenous theater at the NAC. So it coincided with all of these artists coming, which was a bit intimidating also, but wonderful. And then that was a year before, about 10 months prior to working on Moon Lodge as a full production in Vancouver.
So intimidation, topped on top of intimidation. Did you? But once you got on stage, does that all go behind you, or how does that work as an actor?
Well, I think I was, I guess I say intimidation, but it, you know, Margot is a real force. That was to me, that's a musical theater piece. So, and I'm not specifically trained in musical theater. So that was, that alone was quite massive. So just to take on the dance and the singing and really just claim it and really, you know, let loose with it was something. But also, I think there were about 12 characters in it. So so I guess just the really just understanding the journey and specifying each character, all of that, the workload that is required in taking on something like that is quite massive. And then also knowing that Margot working with her company and knowing she would be there, and you know, you don't want to mess that up for her sake.
No kidding. And yeah. Once you've done a run of a one person play, is it a bit of a breather to go back to an old fashioned play, you know, with a cast and so on and colleagues on stage?
I guess this actually was my second attempt at a second attempt at a solo show. I was also fortunate to originate the role by Kenneth T. Williams of Cafe Daughter, and that was the very first solo show I tackled, and I think that was, you don't really know how it's going to happen. There's some part of you that has no idea. Like any magic in theater, we don't really know what it will be. You know, the story is there, and you follow that story, and you know that will guide you through no matter what, but putting all of the elements together is always, it's a very special part of the journey, and also, yeah, it sort of opens yourself up. You have to be vulnerable. You have to be brave, even if you don't want to be in certain moments. But yeah, the experience of working on a solo show changed me, I think, as an artist, because you rely on yourself. You have to trust yourself, and you have to trust what you're actually doing, how you're sharing with the audience, and creating this living, breathing work that is you. We need the audience. we have to participate.
What about your character in The Ministry of Grace? What can you tell us about her, and what attracted you to the character and the script overall?
Well, I have always the very first show that I was ever gifted of seeing by Tara was Miss Julie Shema. And I had no idea. I'd only met Tara probably a day before at this point. And so in Toronto, this incredible script. Tara had written this, adapted this play with an Indigenous storyline. And so it just struck me. And so I immediately fell in love with her work. And her, just as an artist, she, I really believe she's one of the best that we have internationally. So when Tara calls you and says, I would like for you to play this part, you don't think, you just say yes.
So you don't say, well hang on a second, who is she,
and
what's her arc, what kind of character is this?
Yeah. We actually had also done a workshop production of Ministry of Grace, and so I did know the beautiful script. I was able to witness the production, the workshop production, and yeah, it was incredible. It was a beautiful script, and also I think because it is something so close to her, that is part of the art that I'm most interested in being a part of are these stories that have roots for us, that land in a place that only we can access, you know, ancestrally. There's something to be said for these joyful and heart-wrenching stories that need to be told, I had no choice but to say yes.
And so what do you hope audiences take away from it? And I know it's a common question, and maybe it's not fair. I don't know. Do you go out on stage or at some point during the rehearsal and the performance, do you think, I do hope the audience gets this or is moved in such and such a way?
Well, I mean, I really believe in the journey of this story. And so I think that the beauty of being an artist and being a part of something like this, that if everyone, if we are as open to engaging with the audience, and if they are also receptive to the story, then there will be a give and take of what that story is. So I think there is so much to be gleaned from this story. I don't believe that it is a story that many people will know, but it is sure one that will hit you really hard in the best possible way. It's a very, very special piece of writing, and the magic that we're currently creating out there will speak to that.
We'll let you get back to rehearsing the creation. Thank you for joining us at Before Play. It's great to talk to you.
Thank you so much.
PJ Prudat is appearing in Ministry of Grace. Our next guest is Dr. Aaron M. Gilpin, a Salto Cree Métis community wellness researcher, educator, and filmmaker. Her research focuses include Indigenous wellness pedagogy, indigenized approaches to education, Indigenous climate action, land-based leadership and governance, and storied film education. She currently works as the Indigenous Learning Specialist at the Division of Learning and Teaching Support and Innovation at UVic. Aaron facilitates educational workshops and learning opportunities for faculty, staff, and students, develops curriculum for indigenized learning practices, and teaches a broad range of Indigenous studies and governance course content. She also works as a community birth doula, a birth educator, and filmmaker. Please welcome Dr. Aaron Gilpin.
Thank you.
Can you tell us a bit first of what it means to be an Indigenous learning specialist?
Oh, I'm still trying to figure that out. First and foremost, I just want to say I'm just so mesmerized by you both, and I feel really grateful and humbled and honored to be sitting in circle with you. I actually wish I could just continue to listen to you both, and I'm sure we'll go into it. But after having time with your piece and your script, there's just so much. I want to continue to learn from you. So I feel like I should be sitting there. So I'm going to do my best to try to ground myself back into the larger work that you're both doing, that you're all doing. Back to the question, though, an Indigenous learning specialist, I call myself an Indigenous learning support, actually, is someone who really takes up both curriculum and educational material and creates learning opportunities for folks within an institutional setting. So I work specifically at the University of Victoria, and I create spaces for faculty and staff to think through and contemplate with meaning what these concepts like indigenization and decolonization means and how it can really inform our teaching and learning practice within our educational experiences. So yeah, I'm trying to be a helper. That's really how I see my role.
And it sounds like you work with people across like just a broad range of faculty and roles and different disciplines that you
have. Yeah, absolutely. So currently I work with folks across all different faculties, but I also am involved in, as mentioned in that beautiful bio, thank you so much, Taiwo, for taking the time to do that. I also do this type of work within birth educational settings, and so folks who are learning how to do birth doula training, and I also do this work within the realm of outdoor rock climbing as well. So I try to, I have a group called Indigenous Women Climb, and I'm really trying to create more space, which is reflective of my cultural teaching of tatawau, which is a word that means there's room for you here and there's space for you here. So what does that mean in terms of who we are as an Indigenous people and how we are creating spaces that also reflect who we are and where we come from? So it's quite expansive, I think.
Now, you have read the play. What are some of the key themes that it evoked for you when you read it?
Well, I mean, I cried. I felt like I was witnessing conversations between family members. So there was that, I felt related to the piece, like a kinship to the piece and to the characters presented as well. It was the first time I've read a script before, so that was a very new experience for me. And it just, there's so much to say, and I'm aware that I can't really go into it, because once I start talking, I don't want to reveal anything at all, so I'm watching myself.
Sure.
But I will say that it left me with such a hunger to witness the piece as it's meant to be witnessed, because I think that in many of our storytelling protocols and governance and the ways in which we translate our knowledge through oral storytelling, that's really how I know that I will be able to relate deeper to the piece. And so I'm ready to now to witness it in the way that I think that, at least in my perspective, is meant to be experienced. So it left me really excited to see it and experience it in that way.
You mentioned a moment ago, and forgive me, I can't remember the name of the term, but this sense of openness, of there's a place for you here. What did you call it again?
Yeah, so the Cree word for welcome, like welcome, is tatawau. And this is a not really just a word to me, but it's also a framework for governance, a framework for thinking about how we can relate to each other, relate to the land, relate to the waters, and relate to larger cosmology or spirit in a place. I think that it provides an opportunity for us to contemplate protocol of relationship. So it really can be translated and understood as a way to say, there's room for you here, or there's space for you here. And that requires action, that requires, if there's not physical room, how can we make sure that there is room for you here? And so in terms of thinking about through themes of indigenization and decolonization within the context of education, for me it's a helpful framework to think about my responsibilities as I facilitate those spaces so that we can create more space for more Indigenous bodies, for more Indigenous stories, for more Indigenous teachings and knowledge mobilization. So in a way that can really implicate relationships to all, to everyone who is present at that time and place.
And did you see any of the tatawau reflected in the script of the play itself, or maybe it's in the telling of the story and the mounting of the production? Yeah. Did you see a connection?
That's a really great question. I see tatawau being enacted implicitly within the Indigenous characters of the play. And so whether that was through a gaze, through a look, it's mostly in the silence, I think, between the characters, just that knowing of a deeper history and connectivity and relationship to their experience that binds them together. And I think it really is enacted in the silence that really is suspended between those specific characters.
Is that part of the reason you really want to see this rather than just read
it? I need to see this. Yeah, I'm also a learner. I'm an oral learner and a visual learner, and I think that's reflective of a lot of Indigenous learning practices and pedagogies and, you know, the work that we're trying to do within educational settings. And so I have a different experience with text than I do when I'm experiencing and feeling it. And I'm also very expressive. I'm grateful to the Belfry. I'm a part of this is our third annual Indigenous performance showcase this year, so I'm now understanding the role that performance and our embodiment of stories has in spaces like this, and it allows for us to, I think, go beyond what writing papers or having, you know, academic engagement with these types of stories and this types of knowledge does, and it really allows for us to enter into these spaces in a relational way or an embodied way. So I'm ready to engage with your work in an embodied way. I'm really excited for that.
And what about some of your other work? Very impressive list of things you do as a community birth doula, yoga teacher, performance artist, rock climber. Do you think the Ministry of Grace connects with that anywhere else in that praxis?
I thought you were going to say rock star, and I was like, oh, that's a new one. yes. So I think the entity, the being, the relation that really binds together all these different things across this very large spectrum is the contemplation of our relationship to land and waters. And I see the ways in which land and waters is presented as a character themselves within the play. And I see the way in which relationship to land and waters informs the governance between the characters in the play. informs, healing informs these large concepts in terms of the stories that are told about who these people are, where they come from, where are they in this moment, and where are they going. And, you know, these things that feel very disconnected from another, you know, birthing and the ministry of grace and rock climbing are actually not disconnected from an Indigenous standpoint and perspective, because we believe that it's the connectivity and the interconnectivity is what defines who we are. And so in my mind, when we remember that we belong to the land and waters, then we remember that we belong to one another. And that is a theme that I see throughout this piece.
I want to ask you finally what you think the role of theater and plays like this, and maybe the arts in general beyond that, can play in some of the work you do at UVic, indigenization, you know, deconstructing colonialism, and talking about the impacts of colonialism. How can a play like this facilitate the kind of work you're doing, and what kind of a role do you think it can play in society as a whole?
There's a difference between entering into a room and entering into new content or new information from this place. So often within the educational setting, if I'm setting up a workshop or something, it's very easy for the content that we're sharing to remain in the mental state or the mental place. And it is more reflective of Indigenous learning practices, pedagogies, and values when we enter into content, into story, into information, from an embodied place or an experiential place. And so we see a lot of movement now towards land-based learning, towards experiential learning, because we now have the research that demonstrates the impacts and the influence that experiential learning has in terms of our learning and enhancing our learning as well. And so there's in response to that, I kind of want to even say, you know, instead of letting me tell you, let me show you. And let us have a relationship in that, and let the relationship do that, because that really expands relationship and experience and embodiment, I believe, expands beyond that learning moment and implicates who we consider ourselves to be in this larger theme of relationship to ourselves, relationships with Indigenous communities across Canada and beyond, and relationship to land and waters. And so I think that theater, plays, and storytelling and the arts really protects that sacred place of what stories are meant to do, which is meant to carry forward the knowledge that we need to enact protocols and governance which tell us how to be in relationship in a good way.
Thank you for joining us. It's great to have you with
Thank
us
you.
Here as well.
Thank you.
Dr. Aaron Gilpin. Our final guest at Before Play this morning is Carrie Newman. Carrie Newman is a multidisciplinary Indigenous artist, master carver, filmmaker, author, and public speaker. In his artistic practice, he strives to highlight Indigenous social and environmental issues as he examines the impacts of colonialism and capitalism. Perhaps his most influential work, The Witness Blanket, deals with the subject of truth and reconciliation and is now part of the collection at the Canadian Museum of Human Rights. Carrie was awarded the Meritorious Service Medal in 2017, was named to the Order of British Columbia in 2018, and is the current Ordained Professor of Contemporary Art Practice of the Pacific Northwest at UVic. Please welcome Carrie Newman to the forefront. Thanks for joining us, Carrie.
Thanks for having me.
Can you tell us a bit about your own journey as an artist, and what was it about your heritage or your upbringing that inspired you to take the path you've chosen?
I guess I kind of was born into life as an artist. I think we can trace back five generations of carvers in my family, including my father, my great aunt, my great grandfather. So we have. I don't think I ever imagined being anything else. Right from when I was a little boy, I would make my art at craft fairs where my father was selling his work, and flog it to unsuspecting passersby for enough money to buy ice cream or more art supplies.
But your artistic philosophy has evolved over the years. I know that. But I appreciate the flogging bit of the story. How are you driven by a philosophy and an artistic practice these days?
Yeah, that's one of those things. Like, I spent from that early time until probably my mid-20s, really just focused on developing my technical skills. Mm-hmm. And then you start looking for meaning, right? And I did a project in 2008 called the Spirit Pole, which was a totem that traveled around the province. And it was really the first time that I was pulled out of my studio. Up until that point, I'd mostly worked by myself. And when I went and took that totem around the province and was working in community with people, it kind of showed me the difference in impact that you can have when you work in that way. And I sort of credit that with the turning point in this sort of perspective, or the what drives me to do my art differently now. And it's really what led me to eventually come up with the Witness Blanket, which is probably going to be the most important work that I ever get to take part in. I think it's why I'm sitting here right now.
Can you tell us a bit more about that? I mean, I feel on the one hand that so many of us know about the Witness Blanket, but for those who don't, can you remind people what the Witness Blanket is? What was the inspiration, and what's been the result?
The Witness Blanket is an installation that is about 40 feet long and about 10 and a half feet tall. It's made up of items gathered from residential schools, government buildings, churches, and traditional structures from across this country. And it was made in response to the Truth and Reconciliation Commission's call for commemoration initiatives. And it was really paid for by residential school survivors, because they designated money for commemoration out of the Indian Residential School Settlement Agreement. And so I applied for it. I came up with this idea of gathering these things and applied for this project, and it's taught me, I mean, that was back in 2010, I think, that I came up with the idea, and 2012 that I started on this, and here we are 10 years later, and it's still an enormous part of my life. But it's a piece that started out being kind of this, maybe early in my thinking, naive perspective on reconciliation, and it's taught me so much about what that word means and where we are in this country on that. And so I start to look at that now as, and all of the work that I do now, as part of the truth, and that truth unfortunately comes before the justice and the reconciliation. So I sort of dial back that idea that this is about reconciliation. It's one of the steps in the process, but it's a very, very early step.
Truth has to come first.
Truth has to come first, yeah.
But how has your view of reconciliation changed through those years? Because you called it maybe a bit naive, and I wonder if reconciliation is used too often and too easily these days.
I think so. I think that it gets used for the wrong reasons. And when I say naive, early on I was thinking, you know, when we bring people together, and we learn from each other, that's reconciliation. But I started to realize that's not enough, right? We can do those things together, but unless they turn into action, unless they turn into people taking steps to learn more about truth, to then use that knowledge to push for change, right? There are too many things that are still unequal for Indigenous people in this country. And how can we work on reconciliation? How can we how can we do that if we haven't addressed justice, if we haven't addressed truth, if we haven't, like, how can we have that conversation when there's still not clean water on so many reserves in this country? We saw what can happen when there's a water problem in a major center. It gets dealt with right away. Mm-hmm. And yet here we are, you know, we've known about this for so long, and it's one of those things that continues, and as we fix some, other ones go. And it's because we can't just put band-aids on the problem. We actually have to change the system that creates that water in the first place.
What about the Ministry of Grace? I wonder how you see it playing a role in that. I don't know if that's too much of a stretch, or I mean, the arts play a key role in informing people and changing minds, don't they?
Absolutely. If it didn't, then I don't know if I could continue doing it the way I'm doing it. And I think that it does speak to that notion where when we enter into a space and when people see this play, they will learn something. I think that different people see things in different ways, but there are parts of that that when you walk away, it'll change the way you feel. And I think that that's one of the great strengths of art, is that it's not only here, it's also here. And I think, it's one of the things that I think about this, is that when people feel something, then maybe that's when they're ready to make change. When you think about it, when you read a headline in a newspaper and you learn a little bit of data, it can kind of just be set aside because it's not as human. It's numbers. And when you feel something, then maybe you're ready to be uncomfortable. Then maybe you're ready to make the sacrifice, because so many of the things that we have to address, others benefit from, and I include myself in that. I grew up with a lot of privilege, and so I have to take responsibility for that in my life, and push for change through my art.
And do you see connections between your art and this play from what you've read?
Oh wow, yeah. I mean. And sitting here listening to the others talk about their perspective on it, it even drives that home further, because I started, for instance, I'll just take the Witness Blanket for an example. I started that project for a very personal reason, right? My father is a residential school survivor, and so it was inspired in a very similar way to the inspiration that's behind this play. And then you think forward through that, hearing talk about the weight of the work, right? Of how you have to take care for yourself, thinking about the responsibility that carries. There are so many connections through the stories, through the history, through that shared history, between Ministry of Grace and my work on the Witness Blanket. And yeah, I'm almost at a loss for words to describe how deeply interconnected I think that they are.
I want to ask you finally about experiencing a story rather than just reading it or looking at the data, like you say, the headlines, you know, the stuff that's the bread and butter of my business in the media. What kind of reaction have you noticed from people looking, engaging with the Witness Blanket up close in person, or reading your book about it, which I've been reading with my kids, I should mention, or maybe it's a play and seeing it in person. You've talked about this, but I wonder finally what you've observed from people, how it's maybe affected people in your experience.
I think that in this country we have this image that we let ourselves believe about being polite, about being progressive, about being a multicultural society. And we're very proud as Canadians, and I'll set aside my Kwakiwak identity and wear my Canadian identity for a moment to say that we're very proud as Canadians at the way that the world views us, the rest of the world views us. But I think that the lived reality for Indigenous people is quite different from that. And so we grow up not knowing so many of the things that a play like this exposes, that the work like The Witness Blanket exposes. And what I've found is when people engage with these things, and maybe for the first time learn something that they didn't know before that's in conflict with the perspective or the ideas that they carry and have carried for their entire lives, it evokes an emotional response. Sometimes it's anger, sometimes it's grief, sometimes it's disbelief. And I've come up with a phrase that I use to describe it, and I call it emotional dissonance. It's when the two things that are true, because you can have multiple truths at one time, they collide with each other, and that opening of emotion is incredibly important to truth, to justice, to reconciliation, because that's where people are ready to do something, right? And so cry, right? Get angry, feel something, because that's what it takes, right? We have to be uncomfortable.
So I've asked it before, and I'll ask you finally, what do you hope people take away from this play when they leave the theater?
I hope that they see, first, I hope they see the beauty of the resilience between the characters. I mean, there's a lot of love. This is me reading it from the page. I also don't read plays very often, so I'm just imagining those tender moments, and there's a lot of love between Clem and Grace, and I think that's the first thing. But then I hope that they see the conflict and the togetherness of Indigenous perspective and spirituality and Christianity, because I think that at the core of this is Grace is carrying, walking in two worlds. She's carrying this, she's carrying this ministry of grace persona where she's speaking the words of God from the Bible. And she's also an Indigenous person who's connected to the earth. And she uses that. And she takes on some of that weight that we were talking about our art carrying in the process of her journey. And I hope that in seeing that, people take away an understanding that it isn't Christianity and Indigenous perspective that are so different. It's the way that we deploy them, the way that we turn them into something like a commodity, the way that it is in a traveling ministry that's sort of taking advantage of the weak, or the faithless, or the people who are looking for something to hold on to, and that's where we meet, right? That's where there's overlap in, and I hope that it brings about that something, that deep emotional charge, that people need to go through to be ready to. Yeah, be a little bit uncomfortable in where they are in this world for the benefit of everyone.
Kerry, thank you. Thanks as always.
Thank you.
Kerry Newman. My thanks again to all of our guests. I didn't realize the sun you had in your eyes quite as you were speaking to me. Thank you to all of you for coming. Thanks to our audience as well. And a reminder that the box office is open on your way out, just in case you don't have tickets. Thank you.